Welcome to the Eclipse Wealth Podcast. This is your guide to making sense of financial planning and wealth management. It's brought to you by Eclipse Private Office and is here to inform, inspire confidence, and spark ideas that help you take control of your financial future. In each episode, we'll explore the key concepts that drive long-term success. Everything from building a strong foundation to making those all-important decisions as your wealth grows. You'll hear from experienced professionals who live and breathe this work every day, and from private investors who'll share what they've learned on a path to financial freedom. Our first series is called The Client Journey. Each episode takes you through a different stage of the financial planning process, helping you see what's ahead and, more importantly, what's possible. So whether you're just getting started or well on your way, there's something here for you. Let's begin the journey.
In this first episode, we're taking the first steps in financial planning, and I'm delighted to be joined by two accomplished practitioners. So while they fasten their virtual laces on their hiking boots for this journey, let me make the introductions. Mohamed Ouzzaman is an experienced financial planner and the founder of ADL Wealth in London. In addition to advising clients, Mohamed describes himself as a champion of financial literacy. And I particularly like the line in his website that says, "Financial literacy is the foundation of a prosperous financial future." That's a great strapline. I wish I'd written that for this podcast. With us too is Harry Badman from Matthew Douglas Financial Planning, who is based in Suffolk. Harry's midway through his professional qualifications, but he's made a really strong start to his career by pioneering the Thrive by 35 initiative at his firm. And this is aimed at potential clients closer to his own age. And we all look forward to hearing more about that shortly. My name is Max Weatherby, and this is episode one of the Client Journey series. So to kick us off, I'm going to ask this question. Many of our listeners are just starting out. They've got their first proper job, maybe moving in with a partner, setting up home in a flat somewhere. Mohamed, what are some of the issues that younger clients present when you first meet them?
Thank you for the question, Max, and thank you for the invitation to be on the podcast.
You're very welcome.
So the types of things that young people tend to be engaging with me about, anecdotally, to be fair, is, yes, number one, we've got a cost of living issue. And secondarily, we've also got the issue of how on earth do we get onto the housing ladder? And to be honest, it's becoming less and less about getting onto the housing ladder, as in owning your own property, and increasingly more about how do I move from a house share to my own particular property where I can actually afford to rent a one-bed or a two-bed particular property. The dynamics has completely changed, I think, over the last 5 years or so, and definitely over the last 20, 30 years. In terms of what to do about it, it's not easy. Increasingly, I think young people need to be empowered with financial literacy from college days. They need to learn about budgeting. They need to learn about where their career path is going to take them. There was a point that I made a few months ago about studying Mickey Mouse degrees, and that went quite viral. But the point that I was making was not that your degree doesn't have value, but more to do tangibly is financially, how is your degree going to get you that level of income that you must have in order to manage the bills in today's day and age if you cannot rely on your parents' wealth? So I think that's a big part. So financial literacy, choice of education, and then secondarily is having that attitude of continuous learning. So increasingly, a degree is not enough. You need to be thinking about specializing in so many different areas, in these new age type of skills that we have today, AI, automation, that sort of stuff. And that's going to set you apart for any potential employer.
Really interesting there. Harry, obviously you're closer in age than either of us are. You're wearing their shoes, if you like. What are some of the other issues that younger clients present when they come into you at your firm?
I think Mohamed's touched on it there, is the literacy and also just knowing the general steps to take when it comes to their kind of financial journey. A lot of the time when we're going through the conversations with younger people particularly, and you're explaining what vehicles there might be available for them, a lot of them don't know what these mean or we're in a very acronym heavy environment. So you can throw around terms like ICERs and LICERs, and you're looking at go straight over. So I think identifying that a little bit is a big step. I think also a lot comes from pressure. It's the pressure, one, to feel like you're keeping up with your peers. I think it's the pressure, possibly from a societal pressure, to get on the housing ladder because you feel like you're not maybe contributing to society, or you have a stake in society until you're possibly a homeowner. And I think it's also the pressure from having like social media. It's something I'm sure we'll touch on later, but there's a massive drive now where you see the best 1% of people's lives on platforms like Instagram, for example, of people moving in with their partners, or they're buying their first home, or they're on a lavish holiday. And there's kind of that uncoordinated pressure now that people feel, saying, oh, why am I not doing that yet? So there's a lot of things, and helping people actually assess their timelines and saying, you don't have to buy a house tomorrow. I mean, the average first-time buyer in the UK, I think, is about 33 nowadays, which is obviously skyrocketed in recent years. And I'm sure we'll touch on that later.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. And I think, you know, it shows how important what we're talking about today really is. You know, certainly I was surprised when the response I had when I set out to do this, but clearly you're not, because you're dealing with it all the time. Some of the other issues that came up when we went out to our audience before this was, you know, credit. How do you manage credit? And also a bit about protection. So hopefully we'll have time to come on to that as well. But you both mentioned getting on the housing ladder. I think that actually is such an important issue as an aspiration for younger people. And so, Harry, I'm going to turn to you first, because I know you've been leading this initiative, Thrive by 35, at your firm, Matthew Douglas.
Absolutely.
So let's get straight to that. Tell us a bit more about what this program actually involves and what you're doing there.
Yeah, I'd love to. So Thrive by 35 kind of came out of a conversation with myself and our managing director. Our firm, we've got a young core, so lots of people kind of in and around their 30s who have all recently gone through the turmoil of trying to buy houses, whether it be on their own or with partners. And we have a lot of clients who have children or grandchildren that are going through the same kind of issues. And the conversation we said was, I wish there was more that was being done to help those particularly under 35 who don't feel like financial advice is actually aimed towards them. They think financial advice is people in their 50s and 60s who have a nice big pension pot that they want to look after because that's where the money is. But we actually said there's a huge area of the demographic that's just been left by the wayside because they don't feel like it's accessible. So we said, okay, a couple of months ago, we set out and said, if this was to work, how would we do it? And we said, well, the biggest thing is we have to put our money where our mouth is. So that's what we've done. We've said, okay, young people under 35 who are trying to buy their first home have enough struggles, as Mohammed alluded to, with cost of living going up as well. So we'll offer them free financial advice on products that are going to go directly towards buying a house. So whether that's ISAs, LISAs, unit trusts, we'll offer a light touch service where they can sit down, talk to an advisor, have a review like you would do for any new client, and understand what their position is. Are they doing the right thing? Are they doing it in the right manner? Or actually, are they working off historic information? Should they be actually changing their saving style? So it's been brilliant since we've started it. We've had a lot of interaction coming through. And it's really interesting when you talk to people and what the sticking points are, Max. Like you just said there, like credit's a big part, protection's a big part. From our side, it was also going through and talking to mortgage professionals to find out what young people should be expecting actually when it comes to getting a mortgage or saving for a deposit. I was alarmed to find out that the average UK deposit now for first-time buyers is 20%. And the average house price is now 8 or 9 times your income, which is horrifying. I mean, in the year 2000, it was 4 times. So it's quite literally doubled in the last 20 years. And that's why home ownership's dropped, I think, almost 30% in number of under 35-year-olds who own their own home. So that's kind of where this Thrive by 35 campaign came from, to try and help bridge that gap and also provide a little bit of financial education along the way through webinars or face-to-face, but kind of build a bit of a community of the younger generation so that they don't feel, one, that it's isolated, two, that they're getting any less of a support system than they would do, and three, also to kind of help put at ease that, no, you are possibly doing the right thing. And the best part is when we speak to young people and they're doing everything that they should be doing. And it's great. We can say, you don't need us. You've actually been doing the right thing. They might have a LISA set up. They might have also got a cash LISA saved away. They've moved back in with their parents for a year or two to really cut down on the spending because they might have been living in a city where they were spending over, I don't know, £1,500 a month each on rent. and they've put all of that towards their deposits, which is great. So it's tough for a lot of young people. You see the desire and the will from their side to want to take that next step and feel like they're getting out on their own, and getting a house is a big part of that. But also it's about setting those expectations and saying, okay, Rome wasn't built in a day. We don't have to move into the 4-bedroom detached house in house one. There's nothing wrong with having an apartment or having a 2 up, 1 down in a couple of years' time. So that's where that's come from.
Yeah, that's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, I came back to when I was at that stage, yeah, it was 4 times salary, or even you could get one for 3.5 times. But yeah, it is a real issue. And certainly I've got 3 young adults in exactly that situation. So they tell me very much what you hear. Mohammed, is there anything more? I mean, obviously you're down in London, so the problem is even more acute down your way, I'd imagine.
Totally. We still have a culture of home ownership in the UK. In London, I understand that we've got around 47% of all households are actually owned, privately owned, right? So across the UK, average is something like 65%. So we've got parents owning a lot of the property. So I think there's going to be a requirement for new products probably to come out where you've got a different type of guarantor mortgages where you can utilize the equity in your parents' property. I may be putting you in a pretty bad spot, Max, with your children coming up to purchase their own homes, right?
Yes, yes.
But yeah, I don't think we can ignore it. I mean, you've just said in what the multiples were when you purchased your property. Now, when you're looking at average salaries in London or across the UK compared to the average property prices, it's astronomical. Even on a 6-figure salary, okay, 100K, and let's say you go 4 times above that, you're going to get a 400K mortgage, okay? 400, 500K at most. And then you look at a growing family, probably going to need at least a 2-bed, 3-bed home. Then you need to factor in child rearing. If you've got a 2-person household going to work, you're going to be paying for childcare. And if you're on a 100K salary, it doesn't mean you're going to get 100K. You're going to be paying a hell of a lot of tax, right? What is it? What do you get? Something like 4.5 grand a month or so? Okay. So yeah.
Yeah.
After all taxes. So it's not looking great.
We don't want to depress our listeners too much at this stage and put them off. But I mean, Harry, generally speaking, when someone first comes to you, 33-year-old, whatever, in that sort of situation, how long do you envision they're going to be on your program before they're actually in a position to start filling out that mortgage application? I mean, it's early days, I know, but do you have some guidance on that?
From our side, obviously, we're trying to help people younger. The younger, the better. It obviously, is going to be always the answer. If we can start helping 18, 19, 20-year-olds, then they've got 10 years if they want to. I'd say probably most that we've spoken to so far are maybe within 5 years, probably aiming for 2 or 3, realistically. But we've spoken to some who live down in Surrey, for example,
yeah,
and they have like a help to buy scheme.
Yeah.
And we said, well, we're going to need to move that across because, I mean, you can't buy a house in Surrey for less than £250,000. So we're looking at those types of issues. I mean, you've got people like you say that are just starting off. They've got a new job, they're starting a career, and they're looking to save. A lot of people might have been to university, or actually we're seeing a lot more now who are going down the graduate apprenticeship scheme where they're working and earning at the same time and actually seeing slightly better salaries to start with anyway. And they're looking to put that money into it. So I'd say probably a couple of years, but we've opened it up. So as long as you're under 35, if it's probably under a year, I'd say we'd probably say there's not going to be much that we could do from an investment point of view. Same as you would do for any standard investment, because there's just not enough time. The risk would be too much in that comparison. We'd probably put them towards the way of cash and ISAs or along those where there's probably that less risk incentive. But I'd say probably north of 2 to 3 years.
Yeah. And I'm thinking back to Mohammed's opening remarks about the importance of financial literacy and spending time around that. I imagine over those years, you know, you're probably going to be doing quite a bit of that.
Yes, absolutely.
I think I saw somewhere that you ran a webinar the other day. You know, I guess that's all plays to that piece, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're looking to try and do a webinar every month or every 6 weeks that will be on a topic related to it. So, I mean, the one we did last week was on deposits and mortgage rates. So people could kind of understand what the averages are in their part of the world. And as of this week, what the mortgage rates were when you're thinking about actually is now a good time to try and buy, or am I better off trying to hold stead? But unfortunately, my crystal ball is still in the post.
Yeah.
Harry, you should do a session on lifestyle creep. Instagram and TikTok are wrong, you know, and then talk about, look, all of that looks all great. And then it's pushing your expenses 10% higher, 15% higher. Mm. And that's cutting into your potential deposit.
You might have to come and join us on that one.
Brilliant. I'll be over it.
I watched one of your team's videos on YouTube the other day, which you were sort of talking about money habits and good money habits. It was very watchable, I must say.
Cool, no, thank you.
So I can see that that's obviously something that talks to that point. And I wonder whether it's perhaps a good segue, therefore, talking us on money habits and things. One of the bit of feedback that I had from my focus group, shall I call them, said, I feel cautious about using a credit card as I find it easier to manage my finances on my current account and savings account. But I've heard that credit cards are useful for building a credit rating. I don't know, Mohammed, if you got any thoughts on that? Are credit cards a friend or a foe?
Yeah, of course. It is definitely a friend, but it must be coupled with discipline, Max and Harry, yeah? The issue is, do you hand a 19-year-old who watches a whole load of TikTok and Instagram, seeing all the luxurious type of living, and with a balance of £10,000? No, you don't. That creates a disaster, right? But I am an advocate of these credit builder credit cards, where you've got like a small balance, maybe £500, £750, probably max around the £1,000 or so, okay? Just to get that good discipline in place. It doesn't help anyone if you're consistently in debt and you're just paying off interest every month on and on. And it's also about that education. I know Harry would probably do stuff like this, is what you invest in. And I'm a big believer in investing in yourself. Forget that flashy car. If you're going to invest a couple of grand or several thousands of pounds, spend several thousand pounds in learning a new skill. Pay Max to mentor you and everything he's learned over the last 40 years. So that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that sounds good. I can see exactly what you mean. I wouldn't know no more look to have a 19-year-old have a large credit card available, then I would hand them the keys to my car. But we've got to start somewhere, haven't we, Harry? So, I mean, is that pretty much where you take it on your program?
Yeah, I'd agree with Mohammed. I think, like I say, the biggest thing with a credit card from what we see is that discipline of making sure that if you are spending, you're only spending what you can afford. The credit card, it kind of has that weird feeling of, well, it's not really my money, it's not my problem yet. Until then, it is very much your problem and a lot of it. And you think, oh, I've got that credit card with that £4,000 limit. Oh, it's only £2,000 for a nice little trip to Turkey. That's fine. I'll still have £2,000 on my credit card, rather than looking at going, yeah, I've just spent £2,000. I'm now going to have to pay back with interest unless I can pay this off quickly.
Yeah.
There's obviously lots of talk on, I know Martin Lewis does lots of credit card comparisons with these zero balances and balance transfers. But I think it can be quite dangerous to set that precedent of, oh, if I spend, I can just transfer it over to another one and keep going, or paying it back slowly, rather than actually setting that expectation from the beginning of, you only spend on it when you need to. Or I know a lot of people like to use their credit cards if they're maybe making a big purchase and they want to have that insurance from the credit card company. We used to book family holidays, for example. If we were going on one, we'd pay for it on a credit card and then pay it off, rather than just whacking out a debit card. Yeah. So it's a really important skill.
Yeah.
It's discipline more than anything.
So what I've spoken about in the past is the 50-30-20 rule. And there's many, many different variations of this particular rule, by the way. So you look at the net income that is coming in, and then you say to yourself, look, 50% of that, I need to allocate that to my essential expenditure. And then 30% of that is what I'm going to allocate to my non-essential expenditure. And then the final 20%, you're allocating it to savings and discretionary debt payments. And what I mean by discretionary debt payments, and the reason why that is in the 20%, is I'm looking at that element as the debt that you're taking on to advance your skill set. Mm. So if that is from that 20% you want to utilize to learning a new skill instead of paying for a car you can't afford.
Hmm, that's really interesting.
So the 50-30-20 rule, take a look at it.
From that, so I'll jump in there, Max. I mean, do you advise Mohammed then to talk to younger people, for example, to use these smart pot saving methods? I know things like Monzo, for example, you can allocate that it does automatically moves money into certain pots. Is that a big way of how you're encouraging people to do that? Or what ways are you using?
To be honest, anything that helps for that client. And it could be Monzo, Revolut, and similar ones. And even Snoop, because Snoop, they have the great API tool that connects to all of your bank accounts, so you can actually see where you're actually spending money. So all of those tools are fantastic. But some people just want to use Microsoft Excel, right? Whatever works. And some people are fantastic at Microsoft Excel. Just take a CSV file, put it into Excel, and it then portions it into the right categories. I saw a great Excel calculator the other day that is used by a young lady who, right on top of her personal financial budgeting, which is very impressive.
It sounds like instilling good habits early on is so important. I can see that forms an important part of the advice process there. But for someone listening who's perhaps renting at the moment and thinking ahead, is there some way that that rent can contribute to getting a credit score? Is that a possibility?
As things currently stand, private landlords don't report to credit reference agencies. So in that particular manner of speaking, it's not going to have a positive impact on your credit score. But it doesn't mean you don't pay your rent. Again, because when you come to apply for a mortgage, right, they're going to want to see that you've been meeting your obligations. Okay. Yeah. So it's not uncommon to actually see lenders asking for the last 6 months, 12 months of your rental statement, that sort of stuff.
Okay. So I can see, obviously, from that point of view, it's useful to have that. So it does help from that point of view.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, well, I think it'd be very interesting talking around the sort of money habits and things like that. I was going to move on to one of the other topics that came up, and I think is very pertinent to this leg of the client journey. So starting off later on in subsequent episodes, we're going to be talking about savings and things like that. And I appreciate that's a big part of what you gentlemen do. But for the purposes of our conversation today, we're going to park that and leave regular savings to another episode. But one of the points that I was keen to bring up at this stage is a subject that resonates very strongly with me. I've got a particular story that I will share in a minute once we've got into the topic. And that's really around financial protection. We said earlier on that people may well be cohabiting or in a relationship and perhaps maybe have a small child and responsibilities and obligations. Insurance itself can sound boring, something you don't need. I'm young, I don't need it. But perhaps, Mohammed, you could sort of say, well, why should someone in their 20s or 30s care about things like life cover or income protection?
Yeah, really good point. Really good question. When I look at lifestyle protection, I also not only look at it from the point of view of protecting the young person, but I'm also thinking about it from the point of view, look, let's broaden your situation here, because what's going to ultimately impact your wealth between now and when your parents pass away is what the tax liability, inheritance tax liability, is going to be on your parents. So I'm coming at it from a point of view where, look, if you come from a family with modest means, but your parents are still alive and they're relatively healthy, put in place a whole of life policy for them. And if you're one of three or four children, all of you contribute. And if your parents are in their 60s, the whole of life policy isn't going to be cheap. Okay, I'll tell you that now, it's going to be expensive. But when you're sharing the cost of the premiums, it becomes affordable. And it often becomes a lot more rewardable paying into that whole of life policy for the sake of your parents, as opposed to contributing to an ISA or your pension plan, especially when you structure it in such a way where the whole of life payout comes out tax-free and goes into a trust fund for the benefit for all of the children. I look at that as a matter of course, as well as looking at the client themselves. Let's look at what type of industry you're in. Let's see what type of income you've got right now. You need to be thinking about permanent health insurance. Heaven forbid, if you are off work for stress, not any serious illness, but stress, at least there is an insurance company out there who's going to pay up to 50, 60% of your income. That is going to be a game changer in a scenario like that. And then if you've got a mortgage that has to be met, are you going to be risking going into default with your mortgage company? Because until you own a significant portion of the equity or your mortgage is paid off, frankly, you don't own your property. Halifax does.
Yeah.
It's having that type of mindset more than anything. Harry, feel free to jump in.
When we speak to the young people, I think there's also possibly an arrogance around it, saying, well, I'm young, nothing can happen to me.
Oh, tell me about it.
You think you're made of rubber and magic. And unfortunately, that is not the case. And I think the amount of people that work in trade industries where you're reliant on going up and down ladders or carrying things or being able to be on your feet all day, also it ties in the amount of, I know generation, obviously we're very encouraged to go out and participate in sports and activities. So I was a rugby player myself. If you play rugby and you break your shoulder and you are a scaffolder, how are you supposed to scaffold with one shoulder? It doesn't work.
Yeah, exactly.
You either then put yourself in more pain because you're trying to work whilst injured, and then that contributes further down the line with a whole different issue, or you're off work. I know we talk a lot about that kind of life cover and protection, particularly around when people start having young families, making sure that they're looked after, especially when you're young, when you haven't had a chance to really build up a pension pot yet or other investments or other savings. If something happens to you, if you've got a young family, that insurance policy could be the difference between them having a roof over their head or having to then start all over again. I know you've probably got a story about this, Max, but I know one that my mentor, Matthew Douglas, talks about. He had a young gentleman who was a scaffolder who came in. I think he was 28, had a young son, and unfortunately lost his partner. So it was just them and had a granddad. And he came in to get advice and wanted advice on a pension. And during that review and first meeting, the advisor suggested, I think you need to look also at protection because you are in a high risk industry and you're young and you have a dependent. Unfortunately, the client said, I'm not too fussed about talking about that right now. I just want to focus on the pension. And 2 weeks later, they got a knock on the door and it was granddad with the son. And unfortunately, the son had had an accident and he'd fallen off a roof. And the granddad came to speak to us and went, I had fairly convinced my son came and spoke to you about his financial position and wanted to talk to you about the insurance. I mean, it's the importance of paperwork from our side to say that everything was referenced. It was in the letters and the advice letter. But that family were devastated, and we have to be in that horrible position and say, there's nothing we can do. We can help start again. But it's such a simple thing to put in place nowadays.
Yeah.
For the amount of destruction it can do otherwise, it seems almost like a no-brainer.
Yeah. Correct.
Let's just break out the two points there. You make some powerful points there, and I want to come back because I think there's more to say for our listeners. Let's touch on permanent health insurance. Just for the benefit of listeners, that's income protection if you're unable to work. Someone who's in an employed situation, say, I mean, it was employed and self-employed, but someone who's in an employed situation, what's the sort of typical coverage they might get from their company? I appreciate it varies from company to company. What might they expect from a major employer in terms of keeping that salary going?
Generally, as part of the employee benefit package, they will generally pay more than the statutory sick pay. So you're probably looking at full pay for a good 6 months or so, and then half pay for another 3 months. And then after 9 months, you haven't got anything. Now, if you're off work for that length of time, then something serious is in order, right? And if you've got the benefit of a great policy like that via work, that can complement something private that you want to put in place. Because your private policy that you take out, you can set the deferred period to 6 months or 9 months. Okay. It needs to complement what you're getting at work. So that will have a dramatic impact on the price of the policy that ultimately you end up taking out. This is why advice is so important.
Yeah.
You need to be speaking to the right type of advisor for this sort of stuff.
Yeah. So it's good for anyone listening just to sort of check what their employer does. But I can quite see 9 months goes pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Correct.
For someone who's self-employed, yeah, I can see it's vital that they get advice and look into it while you're still young and still healthy. But let's touch on the sort of life insurance bit. I happen to know that there'll be at least two people listening to this who married within a year, child on the way, or in one case, arrived. In terms of what they might get, you talked about whole of life cover, but just very simply, what might be available to them that might be sort of cheap to give them some basic cover. Harry, is that something that comes up with you?
Yeah, from our side, I think that would be a bit later down the line once we've got everyone kind of rocking and rolling at the moment as such with getting those steps. But I mean, Mohammed, you've probably seen more of this than I personally have yet as obviously going through that journey.
When it comes to young families or young families, they don't have children right now. There is possibilities where if you take out life cover and critical illness cover, children's cover automatically come included. It's like a small payment, 20, 30 grand. You really need to check with the insurer. Aviva in that regard has been pretty good. Royal London as well. Other thing that you want to look at is the type of critical illnesses that are actually covered by the various different insurers. Historically, it used to be quite common that they would actually publish the differences in ABI scores. So ABI is the Association of British Insurers. So every particular insurer out there, they would have to ensure their definition for critical illness achieves the ABI standard. But you'd also have another standard, and the other standard was ABI plus. And ABI plus would be more generous in its definition of, let's say, cancer, heart disease, or the various different types of ailments there. They don't really publish that these days, or I've not seen it. If anybody does come across any of those publications, then do send a message through. I'd be keen to look at that. But in the past, when I was looking at this a good 10 years ago, we don't write a huge amount of critical illness cover these days, but more on the whole of life stuff, which relates to all of the succession work. But it was Aviva back then who had been known to have the greatest coverage of critical illnesses at ABI plus level. I don't know if it's true right now. And also bear in mind, I think I've name dropped a few companies now. And we are not being paid any commission, and I certainly am not. All right.
We've talked a bit about that. I think what I might add is that for anyone listening, it is possible to get some basic cover. Basic cover is better than no cover.
Yeah.
Fairly cheaply. And you just hope it's a waste of money. Certainly in my own situation back in the late 1970s, my father and his co-directors put in place an employee benefit scheme at their company. And little did they know that 5 years later he would die. Tragedy for my family. But the result was it wasn't a financial disaster. Myself, my brother, my sister, we were all able to continue our education. My mother, widowed in her late 30s, had a good financial settlement and still with us very much today. I would love to have shaken hands to the financial advisor who went into my father's company to put that in place, because it made all the difference in the world. So it is a bit of a depressing subject, but that's what we're here for. We're here to have those tough conversations with people and to prevent a tragedy from being a financial disaster. But so let's raise the energy here a little bit and focus on some other things. And we are sort of, you know, talking a bit about some protection and things. And one of the questions I perhaps should have asked slightly earlier on is, in terms of protection and safety nets, emergency funds often get mentioned. I mean, I've got short-term needs just like anybody else. I may need to fix the roof at short notice, or I may want to go on holiday. In terms of emergency funds and sort of cash pots and things like that, what's a realistic sum to sort of set aside for someone starting off? Are there some rules of thumb there? Mohammed, do you want to give us your view?
So in terms of emergency cash, all right, the FCA tend to say 3 to 6 months, right? But a good advisor really needs to be looking at the individual circumstances of that particular person, because you don't know what their existing saving levels are. Okay, you need to establish that. You need to look at their expenditure patterns. You need to look at what level of cover that they've got in place. And then you also need to look at how long would it realistically take for you to find a new job. So it's a discussion about around all of those things. And sometimes I've said, you know what, you need a year. You personally need a year in your role. And often it's a misnomer thinking because you're a senior director, a senior manager, it's going to be easy for you to get another role. It's not the case. Because especially if you're in a senior management or a very lucrative role, you're in a very competitive environment. So there's not many of those roles out there. So if you're earning 200-300 grand a year in your role that you have right now, how likely is it if you were made redundant or you had to leave your current role that you're going to move into a similar role with another company? Just look at it. It's just logic, right? There's fewer managers than there are workers, right? There are fewer directors than there are employees. So once again, it's the principle is tailored advice.
Harry, any thoughts on that in terms of what you might be telling your Thrive by 35 cohort?
Yeah, I think we're along the same lines. I think everyone's a little bit different. It's obviously, like Mohammed's mentioned there, the FCA normally around about that 3 to 6 months. I think for us, we get the kickback of saying, well, if I'm trying to save for a deposit, how am I supposed to save for a deposit and an emergency fund? And we said, well, it's brilliant having the money towards a deposit, but what happens if the car goes bang and you can't get to work?
Yeah.
What do you do? I think that's where the 50-30-20 rule that we mentioned also does kind of tie in there. We might mention something similar, but maybe splitting that 20 into maybe 15 and 5, just for case if you're putting one towards a deposit and one towards just an emergency, like say, because if you buy a house, there's no guarantees that 6 months and one day, for example, or whatever your kind of period might be, the oven breaks or the fridge breaks or the washing machine leaks and God forbid the worst thing, the roof comes down. You don't know. You can't just throw all of your cash into one piggy bank and go, right, there's all of my money. Actually having some bits tucked away for rainy days is really important. I think even if you're young, you still have, otherwise you end up relying on the bank of mum and dad. And yeah. I think for a lot of young people, that is their emergency fund still. And a lot of them, if we say to them, if something went wrong today, how would you pay for it? And they go, I'd probably ring my mum or ring my dad. Or they'd go, I'd get a credit card and I'd put it on the credit card. And then we're back into the loop we were before, where you're now trying to pay off a large credit card bill for something you didn't ever expect to pay for.
Yeah. James, I'm looking at the clock and, you know, I've been enjoying this so much and there's so much to wisdom here. And I hope our listeners are still with us. But I think I'm mindful of our listeners and we could talk much longer. But perhaps we just wrap up with a sort of a thing just to say, for each of you, for our listeners, can I only remember one action point from our conversation today to sort of kickstart their financial plan? What would that be, do you think, Harry?
I think for me, it would be that financial advice is for everyone. It doesn't matter if you're 20, 40, 60, 80, so on. It's for everyone. It's worth going and speaking to an advisor, asking the questions that you think might be considered a stupid question. There are no such things when it comes to finances. In an industry, in a world where everything can change on one, in this case, lady's decision in a budget, and it can change the whole landscape of savings and investing, there is no such thing as stupid questions. So go and speak to an advisor, ask those questions, ask if you're doing the right things, and see what things they might have in place to help you, whether it's as a full client or they might have a light touch service like we've done.
Echo that as well, Max. I think with the three of us, we're privileged to be part of a really fantastic industry. Some of the nicest people that I've actually come across are within financial services. There's not an advisor that I've come across in the last, 15 years that I've been in my industry or in this industry that they would deny a 15, 20, 30-minute conversation with whoever you are. So I would echo what Harry has said. Pick up the phone, just find somebody within your local community, someone who may have been recommended to you, and just say, do you know what, can I have 30 minutes of your time? And just listen to me. This is my situation. The stuff that will come out of that 30-minute conversation can be life-changing.
Well, you've certainly given us, been generous with your time today. What I'm taking away from what I'm hearing is the importance of financial habits. I think that 50, 30, 20 is great. And I'm going to be sharing that with the young people in my life. So really just remains for me as host to thank our guests, Mohammed Uzzaman, and from ADL Wealth in London, and Harry Babman from Matthew Douglas Financial Planning in Suffolk. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with us today. For those listening, there are some more information on the show notes, including links to both our guests, follow up with them, maybe find them on YouTube and get some more really good intel. And as they said, better still, pick up the phone and speak to a financial advisor when you have the opportunity. Now, in our next leg of the financial of the client journey to financial freedom, we shall be tackling the subject of financial accumulation in discussion with two more guests, the eighth wonder of the world. We hope you'll join us, and please subscribe to the Eclipse Wealth podcast on either the Apple podcast or Spotify platform on your phone or device. We look forward to you joining us next time. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening to this section of the Client Journey series, then why not subscribe and listen to past and future episodes? You can find out more on our website at www.eclipsewealth.co.uk/podcast. Eclipse Private Office is a trading style of Peregrine & Black Investment Management Limited, who are authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority here in the UK. Please remember that this podcast is for educational and information purposes only. We are not advising whether a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can go down as well as up, and past performance of an investment is not a predictor of future returns. However, if you are interested in discussing any of the topics raised, then please contact Peregrine & Black via our website to arrange to speak with an independent financial advisor. Thanks again for listening, and be sure to join us next time for more conversation along the client journey.